Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Tēnā koutou e te whānau. Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Ed Amon. And I realized today that I've done some episodes, but I've never introduced myself. I was a business professional for a long while, and a senior brand manager in a large organization. But last year, I dropped everything and I embarked on a Masters of Indigenous Studies, which I recently finished. And I'm also a stand-up comedian. But it's not about me. Today, we are going to talk about the book Towards a Grammar of Race in Aotearoa, New Zealand. It is a collection of scholarly work by several scholars and practitioners edited by Arcia Tekun, Lana Lopesi, and Anisha Sankar. The editors also have contributing chapters in the book as well. And we are very privileged today to have one of the editors, Arcia Tekun, with us. Arcia Tekun is a filmmaker and a podcaster and a lecturer at the University of Auckland in ethnomusicology and social cultural anthropology. His research and teaching interests include indigeneity, race, class, gender, religion, food, and popular culture and music in Oceania and the Americas. Tēnā koe, Tekun. How are you today?
Tēnā koe, doing good. Great to be here. Appreciate the opportunity.
Yes, and hopefully, because I always take the introduction down from the website, and hopefully I did justice to that. But we'll just start with just asking you, how would you introduce yourself to everyone?
Oh, nice. Yeah, I think the things that, you know, that's the professional intro, you know, I guess my everyday life is I've got a partner and I've got four kids, and that's a big part of my life. And so I also introduce myself as a dad, as an armchair philosopher, as someone who likes to exercise, but not to necessarily look fit, but to just try to stay where I'm at, because I like to eat. You know, part of my interest in food is both academic and personal.
And
so I trace both ritual foods and everyday foods, and of course I've got to be heavily engaged in all that. And so I would say, yeah, that's a bit about me. I also love watching all kinds of media. I joke with close friends that I learned how to read in my grad program. Because, I mean, now I read all the time. But prior to that, you know, like a lot of my socialization and upbringing was very media based. And so I haven't abandoned that. I still watch probably as much as I read. But that's a big part of I like to be aware of how people are making sense of the world, or how the world is being made sense of for people on their behalf. So, yeah, that's a little bit more, I guess, about my everyday life.
It's interesting. There's certain commonalities there about exercise and food. I don't do food academically, but I do food a lot. And coming from Pakistan, and it's a big part of my. I'm from Pakistan as well, so it's a big part of my my upbringing, my culture, and it's can't do anything without it. And I try to engage in health and fitness, but it is it is an ongoing journey that will forever be with me.
Me too, man. I'm in the fat fit life. so that's where I'm at. So,
yeah.
I should mention, because you did as well, like my whakapapa is back to Ishimuleo or Guatemala in Central America. But I was born and raised in the U.S. And have been in Aotearoa for the last 8 matariki now. My partner's originally from Kirikiriroa, which is what the pull was to bring us out this way initially.
Oh, that's when I came here in 2010. I came to Ototahi Christchurch and just before the earthquake, so that was a fun experience, introduction to New Zealand. What actually brought you to New Zealand in the first place?
Yeah, so my partner was the big pull. She wanted to come back home and give our tamariki a chance to experience some of what she had growing up. But also, it kind of opened up through an opportunity to pursue my doctoral studies. So I got accepted into the anthropology program back, 2014 or so, and I started in 2015 and got into my research primarily around Tongan Faikawa and contemporary practices around that, having been introduced to it in the States, in Utah, all places, and got a chance to come in and the research route gave me my student visa, then my partner got me my residency, so we were able to stick around. And I guess that was the initial was a chance for her to come home, show her kids a little bit of life here. And also, I mean, at least for me, it's such a rich site to study anything in the region. You know, Aotearoa is just placed so uniquely intellectually, politically, culturally, to understand the region, and especially being in Tamaki Makaurau, right? What many will tell you, know, the Polynesian city of the world. And so that just gives so many different opportunities to engage with so many different realms from across the region, but also the region's global, right? So we have heaps of, you know, South Asian, East Asian, such a rich diversity here that really helps understand the region. I at least for me, in my experience being here, just some great insights.
It's interesting. I always ask this question, what got you into academics, because for some people it's just the next step. You know, you finish your first degree and then you do something as a post grad, like a diploma or a master's, and then you just stumble into a PhD. My journey was different, but what was your journey?
Definitely a lot of stumbling for sure. You know, I was a first generation university student, and I was kind of raised on like this meritocracy, you know, propaganda of like, hey, this is the way you're going to make it, and so on and so forth. And I mean, it I actually struggled a lot through my undergrad. I dropped out of 2 different universities. It took me 7 years to get my undergrad degree. I got my master's and PhD in less time than my undergrad, and each one I was kind of stumbling into. But initially I got in just because I heard that whole mantra of, hey, you know, like you get a better job, all that kind of stuff. And I wasn't prepared for it. So as I'm stumbling through university and kind of transferring from a community college or UniTech kind of equivalent to a 4-year institution, I didn't realize all the prereqs that I needed for all the stuff that I initially planned on studying. I wanted to get into sports science actually initially, and exercise and sports science. And then I ended up taking an anthropology class and I was like, man, this is cool. Like I could actually talk about culture. This is, you know, that was interesting. And in the end it was more, I guess, practical than the original route that I wanted to do, because I didn't have any of the prereqs done. So I got my undergrad in anthropology and I really enjoyed it. But then by the end of it, I realized, oh man, like nowadays I feel like I need maybe a master's too. and I really enjoyed anthropology. I loved the topics, but I also felt that pedagogically sometimes it was a bit bland, right? Speaking of food metaphor, right? Need a little spice, need a little seasoning.
Exactly.
So I got into a master's of education, and I did that at the Education, Culture, and Society program at the University of Utah. I had no idea what I was getting into. I got in, and at that time, it was the only program that I knew of that at the uni that I didn't require like a post-grad pre-exam. You know, because it's a big thing in the States, right? GREs and all that kind of stuff. And so I was like, man, I'm horrible at tests. I've barely survived here. That program sounds good to me. And then I landed into this really theoretically rich program. Got exposed to decolonial theory, post-colonial colonial theory, indigenous studies, indigenous epistemologies, queer theory, critical race theory, the Black radical tradition. I mean, just you name it, it was there. Marxism, everything. And I was just like, wow, it was overwhelming. But that's where I feel like I learned how to read, because I was like really getting into stuff. And at that point, I think everything shifted and it no longer became about a job. It started to become about, man, I want to learn. I want to understand. And I want to try to find ways to make or to better understand the world that I've experienced. And at that point, everything shifted for me intellectually. And so when it came to time for the PhD, I did apply to a bunch of places in the States, and then I applied at University of Auckland. Things were kind of rough financially, you know, the U.S. and struggling, and you know, and I was like, maybe it won't work out. And so in the U.S., you got to pay fees for the PhD programs. And in the end, me and my partner were like, you know what? Maybe we're just not going to do it. So I didn't pay for any of my fees. But then I got an acceptance letter from University of Auckland. And I was like, hey, I didn't pay my application fee. They're like, we don't charge application fees. And I was like, what? Wow, that's cool. And so, you know, wasn't going to do it. But because I had received that acceptance, sat down with my whānau and were like, hey, you know, should we consider this? And it was an opportunity then for my partner to come back home, for our kids to get exposed to Aotearoa. And at that point, I was like, man, I got in. Sweet. And I kind of made a little shift, still in anthropology, but got opportunity to do ethnomusicology, which is, in essence, right, how people make music and how music makes people. In essence, it's like anything you want it to be, but just using sound as the metaphor or as the site of study to better understand different phenomena. And there's a lot of overlaps with pop culture, which I was kind of getting back into at that time as well. You know, as far as my interests and again, long story. I was gonna say long story short, but I've already kind of been going. But yeah, so and at the end, I came, found a great group of people to work with, really opened up my world even further. And then everything that I had read, all that theory that I had read in my master's, finally started to make sense. And I look back and I'm like, oh man, all my poor professors, I thought I knew what I was talking about, but I was just reacting to stuff, right? And then now I reread all these theory and I was like, oh, that's what it really means. I totally was off the ball. or maybe I was like just, you know, I was kind of there, but not really there. And so it really gave me a chance to drop down. And then, yeah, at that point, it was less about a job and more about, hey, you know, I'm really interested in thinking about ideas, trying to figure out, what are the right words for those ideas? And or can we come up with new words or new expressions or metaphors to make better sense of, you know, issues or problems we see in the world? And you know, try to be the best at it as I can and find a way to, you know, pay the bills, you know, however possible. But yeah. So at that point, And so I always have to remind my kids of that too, because I'm like, hey, man, you know, people got to pay to go to uni to listen to me. I hope you get to listen to me for free. Doesn't always work, but I try.
it's a great journey. And there's some parallels with me. I mean, for me, growing up in Pakistan, it was the only path. I mean, that was the, and my dad, my father is an ophthalmologist. He's a doctor. So, and I'm the eldest child. So that was the path set for me. I was to become a doctor. And I could have, but because I was young and stupid and rebellious as well, I was like, I'm not going to do what you tell me to do. So, but within the framework of South Asian strictness, right? So I said, I'm not going to become a doctor. So my dad said that, listen, if you're not becoming a doctor, you got to get into the best university for business in Karachi. I was in Karachi. So I busted my ass and tried to get in there. And then I stuck to business for like, until 2021, and then I got out of it just recently, as I said in my introduction. And it was amazing that I did it until the path It was not really chosen by me, but I just chose it because, okay, that's the path. I have to be in business. I have to earn some money, pay, earn, money. And, but then living in Aotearoa a little bit changed me in the sense that I started focusing on the society a little bit more and trying to find my place here. And I said, what the hell am I doing? So I just totally cut my path and started a new one, which is fantastic because I love it. Because study in the past was like, I study, that's the work, and then I do the stuff that I enjoy separately. Now the study is the stuff that I enjoy, and it's a great combination. So yeah, it's I completely relate to how the different people journeys work. Our listeners will be, talk about the book finally. I said, okay, all right. How did you, because I've read some background and listened to some of your podcasts as well. So it's a very interesting story. How did the project come about?
Oh man, yeah. So I feel like, I talk a little bit about it in my chapter, drawing from Fred Moten and Stefano Harney's The Undercommons, Fugitive Planning and Black Study. And I kind of feel like I met my co-editors in The Undercommons, right? Because we were all in institutions of higher learning or tertiary learning at the time. But Lana was just across the street at AUT. Anisha was in sociology and previous to that in philosophy. And I was in anthropology. And somehow we cross paths, and we would begin having different types of conversations around things that we were interested in that may or may not have been things that we were able to take it within our own disciplines, perhaps, or even the own realms that we were in. And so we kind of, I guess it was like the conversations you have in the hallway or outside of classrooms that kind of began to forge, I would say, these intellectual relationships and personal relationships as well. And so we kind of had that base. And that continued, 2020 was a major catalyst for sure for a lot of things around the globe. And at least the way I recall it, we have this global pandemic that's hit. Mm. And this is another just kind of reflection, side note reflection here, but, I feel like in the past, growing up with dial-up internet and the 90s and that kind of stuff, right? Like, what's on TV is on TV. And so, like, I feel like more people are watching the same thing at once. Yeah. But nowadays, right, there's so much stuff all the time everywhere. Mm-hmm. But I feel like the pandemic kind of maybe was a flashback to the past a little bit, where because there was more people isolating at home, there was more people paying attention to the same kind of places and media. It was almost kind of like a memory of what that was like, before, where everybody's kind of watching the same thing, and then George Floyd gets killed.
Yeah.
Right. And it has this global, I mean, this stuff is not new. People, mm-hmm. Know about this stuff that are in the, have been, Black Lives Matter is a lot older than that particular moment.
It was the straw that broke the camel's back,
There you go. Full on. Right. And so then, everybody watching, and there's this major catalyst, and then you're in the midst of a global pandemic. And I feel like that also catalyzed our conversations. And, Lana, Anisha, and myself, we're also kind of, we began this, I guess, what is it, a book club or a reading group, and wanted to read stuff that we felt that other people around us weren't necessarily reading. We wanted to think through it together. And so we grabbed, a variety of different texts, and we were using that to try to make sense of what we were seeing occur. Because, while Black Lives Matter has its unique context that it's emerging out of, it's also related to global phenomenon. And it also had this global kind of chain reaction where you're seeing these ruptures, kind of organizing around Black Lives Matter in, from the Papuas in Oceania to the UK and everywhere in between. And a part of that too was like seeing how language was being adopted, right, in different contexts, and how at times that was creating certain tensions, even in myself. Like, I was not always comfortable with how I was seeing certain terminology adopted you know, kind of decontextualized. And at other times I thought, oh, this adoption seems quite practical and useful at the same time. So I was kind of feeling both ways, depending on what was being said and how it was being said. Anyways, me, Lana, and Ani are having these conversations around the stuff we're reading and this moment. And then we start kind of saying, hey, maybe we should put stuff together. You know, Lana had an experience with Bridget Williams' books. She's got two books with them prior to this, and had that hookup and connection to get us thinking about, hey, man, let's put together a book. And then in the process, too, we're like, man, we need to get some more voices in here. And so each of us, you know, kind of reached out into our own little networks. And there's some overlaps in there as well. But, you know, cast that net wide. And, you know, as far as, you know, with academia, right, you've got to cast it wide because half of them aren't going to be available, you know. And then you go with that half, and then a couple of those might, you know, have things come up. And so, in the end, we have a really rich group of really diverse scholars from diverse backgrounds, perspectives, and disciplines that all were willing to kind of contribute to this conversation and bring together all those different voices and even disciplinary backgrounds, right? We, even me, Lana, and Anisha, right? We, it's kind of like anthro, ethnomusicology, art, and Pacific studies, and sociology and philosophy. And we didn't always have the same agreement on the understanding of terms and how even race is understood or interrogated or analyzed within those different realms. And so, you know, that, you know, just spread even further once we had all these amazing contributors join in and add some more. And that's kind of, I guess, what we wanted to do in the end was have a little bit of something for everyone, but also put everything together as much as possible, building on the work that's been done here before, but also trying to really tap into that global conversation as well, because that's, I think, what part of the catalyst of the book was. We were seeing, you know, locally we're connected to the globe, and then at the same time the globe is here, and we got to try to find better ways to make sense of that messiness and that kind of complicated reality a bit more, especially along the lines of race.
Yes, and it was like a wild journey reading the book as well, because I was, you know, I come from a different place from as compared to all the writers in there. So you start connecting to different things, and other people might be connecting to other things. So me coming from India and Pakistan, the previous India and the current Pakistan. And so I have a different history of how people talk about Faka Papa. I have a, you know, when people talk about connection to the land, mine is a weird, it's a 70-year-old, and I lived through the imagination of my grandfather, but he was a disappointed man after many years of independence, but was that real independence? So it's like a complicated feelings that you have. And so you start connecting to, so and I learned so many new things, like the West Papuan chapter. It was clearly mentioned in that it, you know, people become racialized and then ignored. And all of a sudden I realized that this has been happening, and I knew about it, but I would just generally just ignore it unconsciously, subconsciously, whatever word it is. And also certain topics that were introduced in there, like the model minority in one of the chapters, and the diversity mascot. Yeah, so those kind of fitted well with mine, with my brain. So I would recommend whoever is hearing the podcast, you get the book, you will find connections in different places. So I found it intriguing. You mentioned it in the first chapter, but the name is not a grammar of race. You know, a lot of people write books and then it's like a very title which is just exact. It's like a self-help book, and its answers are in there, right? But you added the word towards in there. What's the idea behind it?
Yeah, no, absolutely. You nailed it on there, right? Like, it's not a self-help book. For sure. And I think that, one of the conversations we were kind of working with as well is, I mean, it can be a little bit of a long title for some, but at the same time, that towards adds a little bit of, adds some mobility, right?
It's a journey element.
Yeah, and we want to just kind of, remove a fixed nature of kind of reading it. Like, this isn't the end. It wasn't the beginning either. It's something that's, you know, in conversation with stuff that's already been talked about here and around the globe, but also just kind of trying to bring to, just like the conversations me, Lana, and Ani were having, bringing the different disciplines and backgrounds that we had together into the same place. And is there a way that we can have more meaningful discourse instead of talking past each other, for example, on various levels? And so that towards a grammar of race was kind of, how do we bring together all these different terms, these different languages, these different disciplinary backgrounds, and even personal backgrounds together in the same place? And perhaps there's tensions there. And we were, that was what was productive for us. I mean, there was tensions in the way we were coming into the conversation just because of our training and whatever. And we found those to be productive once they started to rub against each other, because we're like, okay, wait a minute. You know, maybe we need to find new language, or maybe there's not the language here. So we started looking to North American scholarship, and that was very productive. But then at the same time, there was limits because, okay, Aotearoa is also unique, but it's connected. And so towards the grammar, I think, is part of that, reflecting that movement, that mobility. This isn't closed off. It's not a self-help book. It's a book in transit. It's you know, bringing together the language that exists right now, the language that people are using, and perhaps even also bringing in new language to catalyze further, we hope, more responses. And part of that too is bringing to the surface, you mentioned, you know, earlier, like, you know, some of the stuff that's there, but we don't know, you know, it becomes invisible. So we want to bring to the surface or make visible part of what we felt was always there. And that's where grammar serves as a, I guess, a multiple meaning metaphor, right? On one hand, grammar is the language, the terms, the concepts that are all kind of being brought together in a way. But grammar also is then extended as a metaphor, right? It's a rule of language. But we don't always identify the grammar. You just speak with the grammar of whatever language rules you have. And it's there, and it's underlying the way that even we're communicating right now in order for us to be able to understand each other. And we wanted to say, hey, how do we identify that grammar? But socially, right? How do we bring to the surface this social architecture or structure that is invisible, but is nonetheless animating our societies in many ways, and particularly around the scaffolding of race within our social worlds, and how, a lot of times you think about the history of it, and there's several chapters that get into it. There's so many centuries of investment in this idea of race. And then all of a sudden, okay, you know, you have this major political movements that have said, okay, racism is not a good thing. So then people are backing away from using that term, but it doesn't just disappear. You know, centuries of investment doesn't just disappear because you don't want to, you want to avoid it. And then it just shapeshifts. People use it in different ways, or is produced in different ways. But yeah, that's what we wanted to kind of point to.
Yeah, it's an interesting element, which was mentioned in the book about the history of race, and almost all chapters kind of mention it, in the sense that it is all of a sudden we want to ignore the aspects of race. Ignore the history of race. All of a sudden, we need to cut it. It's the same conversations we have with equity, that all of a sudden, we don't want to talk about bringing people up who have been crushed through colonization. All of a sudden, we are all equal, right? We want to start from a base where it's all equal, but we don't want to invest or recognize what we have done to people in the past to bring them up, right? So that's what happens with race conversations as well, and with my personal experience as well. People become very definitional when they are racist. When you're talking about as a comedian as well, I get that as well. So somebody says something which is a colloquially racist thing, might not be definitionally racist, and their defense is always is, well, that's not race. I just told you to go back to where you came from. That's not a racist thing. I'm just telling you to go back to where you were born. So it is a very interesting fact that people are just running away from talking about the actual term, but are not backing away from the actions which might be based on race.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think, and that's where there's those, the chapters are, what I like is that they're so diverse that we have some that have like these very locally specific examples that can really look at that tangible material ways in which race is produced and like those examples you've given. And then we also have some other ones that are maybe more focused on like the theory and the ideas and the ideology that underpins it. Like you mentioned, right? Where, you know, I mean, here in New Zealand, it's, I mean, all I can do is crack up at it, you know, but like I hear stuff like casual racism or soft racism. And I'm like, what is this? I'm like, so there's like, it's like saying, oh, I was just softly abused, right? Or I was just, you know, casually oppressed. And I'm like, you know, I'm like, if we think about what's actually being said there, and it reminds me of like one of Malcolm X's speeches where he's talking about like Novocaine, and he's like, oh yeah, you know, it's like, so we can suffer peacefully. and I think, yeah, that's definitely what, you know, what we're trying by bringing the grammar to the surface, both the material intangible and the ideological immaterial intangible that underpins it, right? That justifies it, that makes it seem normal or invisible. Then we can actually maybe more meaningfully confront it and be like, hey, you can't just ignore it and have it disappear. This is something that is part of the world as we know it. And if we really want to overcome it, then we need to actually more transparently and honestly confront that and see, you know, what it actually is, how it takes on so many, and it's contradictory. I mean, the concept of race is contradictory. I mean, that's, I guess I should mention that, right? Like when we're talking about it, and that was one of the tensions that emerged in our early conversations coming out of anthropology, my undergrad in bioanth and evolutionary ecology and all that kind of stuff. Like we had to very early on confront that race was science at one point in time. Right. And so when we're talking about race, we're not talking about biology. We're not talking about genetics, but that legacy still echoes through today. Mm. I mean, if you're a sports person, I mean, I watch this all the time and you see how people talk about, you know, darker skinned racialized bodies as, you know, being more athletic or these are the things that echo of the genetic notion of race, the biological notion of race is definitely still echoing through. So that's not what we're talking about, but it's still such a big part of it. Right. And so, you know, getting those terms and trying to, you know, lay that out. Right. Is, I guess, part of that process. Yeah.
Yeah. Regular people do think, I mean, in the recent contemporary New Zealand context as well, I mean, the talk about, co-governance and Te Tiriti o Waitangi, the people opposing it, they always racialize, the context is always racialized that we can't have equitable distribution of wealth, or we can't have adherence to the treaty because it is based on DNA. And it is based on, we can't do that because it's racist, because it's based on DNA. And it becomes a very racialized. And so I wanted to take that further with the conversation about biculturalism and multiculturalism. Coming from Pakistan as a Tangata Tiriti or a Tauiwi, it's a very interesting thing that happens around me in New Zealand when people start talking about biculturalism and multiculturalism. Both have immense issues in it. So how do you contextualize it in your brain?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that, I guess, not an end all answer, right?
Exactly.
But one, the process in the moment and some of the things that we talk about in the book, right, is it is confronting that, right? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, liberal multiculturalism on one hand, right, has this face of trying to combat racism, at least through language or you know, lip service. But then when we look at the structures the society, it continually produces those same structures. If we look at just who's over incarcerated, right, who's incarcerated in the first place, and then who's not in universities, right? I think about, you know, even in my fields, and I look across, you know, the demographics, and I'm like, not a lot has changed in the last century, but the language has. And so, has, you know, what has actually changed? And I think multiculturalism, absolutely, that I think the paradox or the contradictions in that is revealed throughout the book and several examples of, it isn't, right? Like it is the, to use like Seming Mok when she talks about, the diversity mascots, right? And and you know, tokenization, it is a way to kind of distance from actually looking at the grammar of race, the power that works through race, because now you've kind of like, you have the same structure with a different color, or at least you put, you know, you put a little bit more, or to use Rawiri from the Maori party, he was saying, hey, you know, this policy looks like a white cake with some chocolate sprinkles on it. You know, to use that example, that's what's going on. But then it's then framed as bicultural, and I think that's the other, you know, struggle as well. And I mentioned this in my chapter where I'm like, you know, is it bicultural when we think about public national holidays? It's all Christian, Eurocentric, Gregorian calendar-based public holidays, with the exception of one this very year, right, of Matariki, which was finally publicly nationally recognized. So how is that bicultural, right? And so really, those are different layers of kind of, again, exposing the contradictions of race, that racial hierarchy is still very much in place structurally, because we're in New Zealand. Right, you know, we're trying to reach Aotearoa, Te Ika a Maui or Te Waipo Namu, but New Zealand is right there in the way, right? It's the border patrol agent that's guarding the entrance to anything else. And so, is it bicultural? I guess is the question that is raised. Is it multicultural? Is then the next layer that's raised? And then we're at times then pitted against each other in that process to uphold the already kind of standing hierarchical structure.
And one thing I, after reading the book, I reflected and I realized that these terms or defenses of the term of biculturalism or the concept of multiculturalism is always, or most of the times, not a scientific fact, I'm guessing, but most of the times is used to negate a thought or a protest or a demand from an oppressed minority. So, like, so if there is talk of adherence to the treaty, right? We talk about biculturalism, but we forget about the multi-layered nature of Māoridom, where each iwi and hapu and whānau have their own whakapapa of culture. Right, so it's a very interesting thing which was introduced in the book, which I realized that I think I forgot which chapter it was introduced in, but I think Maori and a monolith was created by colonialism, so they didn't exist as a monolith before. It was the own society going through. So using biculturalism in certain ways might negate the diversity of Māoridom, and then you go on to multiculturalism, then that also kind of negates the indigeneity of, so you know, it makes Māori a minority in their own land. You know, if you talk about multiculturalism, all of a sudden, oh, we have to have all minorities equal, but that's a special status. They're indigenous, right? So I'm just talking through my brain, because that's what happened with the reflection. When you read the book, you all of a sudden start thinking about these different aspects. I guess that was the goal.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I was thinking, you know, as you mentioned that, right, Garrett Cooper's chapter, right, he adds these layers of, the complicated, you know, internal politics and tribal bureaucracies, and then you have Po Namu in his chapter, kind of with what you mentioned, right? He's like, we're going to be tenants in our own land, if the trajectory continues, and so that is a unique category, and I guess that's the other, and that can be a tension, right, with different ways of thinking about stuff. We're focusing on race, but race overlaps with indigeneity at times, right? And that sometimes it's that tension, right? Race is a way that sometimes indigeneity can be brought into the mainstream, in order to kind of remove or erase what you're mentioning, right? That particular political status of indigeneity, and then vice versa. Sometimes race will then erase other groups' indigeneity as well, where we're talking about like Tangata Moana, for example.
Yeah.
And so we wanted to, you know, be able to open that up because, they're happening at the same time. Mm. And sometimes they're at tension and are at odds, but that's because of the structures that have created it that way. Which again is always about just reinforcing the same structure of power, right?
Yeah. So one thing I noticed was, and it was like an enlightening topic for me, and it might have existed since many years in academia, the concept of racial capitalism in the book. And it all of a sudden gave me an idea that, oh, maybe I should base my PhD on that, because I'm working on an idea, but that's more based on Moana Jackson's Matiki Mai report and having a treaty-based constitution. But all of a sudden I read about racial capitalism. I said, oh my God, this is a whole new thing. It's not a whole new thing, but for my brain, it was a whole new thing. And it was an amazing enlightenment moment for me that what colonialism was about power, but it kind of was all about capital and money and individualized preference in terms of land. So then I focused back on East India Company in India, and I was like, oh my God, it was all capitalism. So it's did you while reading through these contributions from different people, did you have these moments even though you have a PhD and everything, you all of a sudden going, oh my God, what, this is a fantastic way of thinking?
Oh yeah, absolutely. On one hand, as an editor, there's a lot of admin work. That was probably the biggest struggle. But the best part was, being able to read everybody's chapters and their, what, you know, all those different lenses to make sense of that, and even again, like these shared terms that maybe we were thinking about differently. And I think again that began with the reading group with Lana and Anisha, where we would have got stuff out of the book on our own, or the different books that we were reading. Think about like the Intimacies of Four Continents, for example, by Lisa Lowe, and you get a lot of the racial capitalism stuff like that, or the way capital works through race. But then being able to think through it together, we would have these different insights. And then when we add all these other contributors as well, it opens up a constellation of possibilities in it to understand this phenomenon around capital and class and power. And it could be based off of land, right? The enclosure or privatization of land and how that's related to colonialism and the impact on indigenous folks. It could also be around labor and who's doing what. Or if we think about, you know, the quote unquote first and third worlds, like there's a color line there that is always assumed in that. But even to extend it further, I mean, of course, gender is implied in there also. But then also, that's the material tangible, but then, you know, something that I think Anisha does great in her chapter as well is like really signaling to those metaphysics of race, where it, you know, that material or that tangible is ideological, right? And is part of a reality that can extend and move beyond. And I think that's another thing that helps complicate it further, where yes, we can look at consistency of likelihood around particular types of bodies, but it's not just about the body, because sometimes that metaphor can be extended beyond it in different ways to apply that oppression, right? Because with the logic of race, or even like anti-blackness, there's already an assumed norm, and so if you can extend that in other places, then you might be deploying race without realizing it in order to, you know, maintain a particular hierarchy of power around class, or, you know, you can I guess in other terms, like ideologically or darken people in order to oppress them, right? Because then it makes sense, because, you know,
it is interesting that you mentioned that before, in terms of the first world and the third world, so-called, all right? And I've read some literature around the fourth world, which is kind of ignored a lot of the times. And it's so contemporary. I mean, in the coverage of natural disasters, or in the coverage of the recent war in Ukraine as well, that language came out so openly, where people were like, oh my God, this doesn't happen in our backyard. It happens in a third world. And they openly said it. And I was like, how can you, even if you are thinking it, why are you saying it? So it's, it is that dichotomy or that we have created over time. Do you think that is a product of just Western colonialism? Because it was, it didn't, I don't see it in literature on histories when we talk about empires before the 16th century. It started coming on in empires after that's a backward area and that's a nicer area, and those are the brown people and these are the white people. And so what's your thinking around it in terms of developing these two worlds that we have created in our brains?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think, you know, where I'm at the moment and having just finished this project and reading everybody's contributions and working together with Lana and Ani, I would signal towards pointing to modernity, right? Yeah. And as a, where race is a modern Euro-imperial invention, it coincides in that way. And that isn't to say that there wasn't oppression before, right? It isn't to say there wasn't othering before, but you have a new globalized form of power that perhaps has brought together all these different forms of power. Myself personally, I like to draw from the coloniality, decoloniality project, where they refer to it as a colonial matrix of power, right? Where we can see the convergence of capital, race, gender, and empire kind of coming together in a very unique way that's unprecedented on this planet. And I think that's the key significant difference. Again, there was stuff before. There was massive stuff before. But at this moment, it's unprecedented in that, in the scale and in the logic that's used, such as the racial dichotomy, particularly around whiteness and blackness, and then everything in between that gets used as buffers in that, gender and the dichotomies around that.
And also it wasn't a unified global project. I mean, starting from the papal bull. I mean, no, before that, nobody was doing that. I mean, it's all of a sudden, it is as you said, it was happening before. It was happening in the all different empires, in the Islamic Empire as well. Reading the history of it, but this became a, like, for instance, different countries was working on the same model. So the Dutch East India Company and the British East India Company are working exactly. They might not have any connections, but they're working on the same model of capitalist colonization, which starts with racialization of the people they are living in the land. So,
Absolutely. I think that's a, you know, good way of putting it. Like, we think about the geopolitics of our world, right? Yeah. It didn't come out of nowhere.
Yeah.
But the fact that we're all subject to global capital, and the fact that that's a racialized capitalist system, it's a gendered capitalist system, it's colonial and it's imperial to a particular point in time. And yeah, it's messy because there's a shared kind of project that also isn't shared, right? It's connected. And because, like you mentioned, right, it begins to take on different faces in different places. And I guess speaking to the book, that's one of the things that we were trying to do, is we were trying to make those links to this global connected legacy, but at the same time speak to kind of the specificity of some of the local unique formations and the way it shows up here. And sometimes that, you know, it aligns really well, and other times it diverges, and other times it conflicts. I think, you know, Lana chapter on the digital rub and thinking about online. That was it's great to kind of demonstrate how you have this language out of the UK, the US, and here, and they have their own unique contexts, and they're connected, but now they're digitally connected, but you're also seeing the collides online because they're connected, but not exactly in the same way. Yeah. And how do we make sense of that? And I think that's part of the reaching for a grammar that helps make sense of that as well.
Yeah, it is. And it was quite interesting to read one of the concepts that I found really, really enlightening was so there's colonialism and then there's the coloniality.
Yeah.
Right. So I recontextualized it in my history in Whakapapa is that I'd look at Pakistan, I was like, okay, people always tell me, why are you worried about colonization? Because the British left. Well, I said, and I always was never able to kind of verbalize the problems. But now with the concept of coloniality, which is like a leftover system, which was shown in the Indonesian, the way Indonesia acted towards West Papua. And it's the same kind of thing. I started making parallels of East Pakistan, West Pakistan, and the creation of Bangladesh, how the remnants of colonization all of a sudden became so deep-rooted that it stays in the constitution and the rules and the laws. And specifically, it's just the basic thing of white. We have skin whitening creams to be a better person or a better be able to get more opportunities. It's so openly there that you put the cream 14 days, you'll get married to a wonderful man. So it is. So thank you for putting that together, because it kind of fixes some of the inner battles that you're having, and you're like, oh my God, I can verbalize it now. So which was great through this book.
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah, drawing from Nelson Maldonado Torres and the coloniality of being.
Yeah.
So great. Yeah, it's like it's that how that power continues even beyond colonial administration.
Yeah.
And I think for again that quote unquote third world, like that's very much the case. And I think it's important to start there too, because that's the majority of the world, right? It's the majority experience of this planet. And so how do we put that into conversation with where we're at too in the settler colonial context of Aotearoa New Zealand? For sure.
So I can talk about this topic because of what I'm studying and my background for hours and hours. But I want people to read the book, not just listen to the podcast, buy the book and read the book. So just coming to the end of it, what's next on your plate?
Oh, man.
What's happening?
Man, a lot of stuff. But I guess like intellectually, putting together this book, it was a lot of work and it was very enriching. And I want to do it again. But perhaps I still have my PhD thesis that I haven't turned into a book. So I think that's the next thing in line that I have. But having done this project, I need to rethink my own thesis and critically reevaluate that. And so I think definitely, my previous work was around, the ritual food of kava and the contemporary engagement with that in diaspora contexts. But now having done this and read all the things here, I want to fuse those together and be like, okay, how do those two things play out in different ways, and how are people perhaps finding ways to relate to each other in ways that undermine the hierarchy that we're kind of forced into, in the global grammar of race. So that's one thing on my mind. Another one is thinking about this stuff in a specific context in Tonga with a colleague of mine, Natasi Ulua. But yeah, that's kind of on the radar at the moment. And I'm sure Lana and Ani have a ton of stuff to put out there as well.
Yeah, I wanted, I wanted all three of you, but it was like, I was like, oh, so it's there, because all of you are like on the move somewhere at the moment. There's something happening in your lives, which was like, okay, it's fine. I mean, I could even talk to one of the contributors, but then Luke on Bridget Williams said, oh, Arcia is still available, I think. And I'm like, okay, let's talk to him.
No, it's great. No, everyone's moving different spots. Lana's currently at the University of Oregon, and Anisha's doing a PhD in Canada, and so doing big things, both of them, and which is great, you know. And I'm sure all the contributors too. These are all people that I follow, and you know, they're a lot of young scholars in here as well, and activists also. That you know, were telling the story, you know, that like the Black Lives Matter march down in Wellington, and that was great too. So these are all, great, because now keeping the focus on all the work they're doing, and there's a lot of stuff that'll stem out of it, I'm sure.
So in the end, any place people can follow you, I heard your podcast on Podbean, but what's out there in social media if people want to follow Tekun?
Sure. I think that one, Podbean, it's on Spotify and Apple Podcasts as well. I am on Academia and ResearchGate, I guess, you know, for those who aren't familiar, right? Like when you're a professional nerd, that's the social media, right? For the professional nerds. If you want to do some reading, I try to put as much of the stuff I can on there. And those are probably the easiest ways to kind of keep track of that, of the kind of the different works that I'm doing. And then I'm not currently on any other social media at the moment. And I just recently just got off of a few of them, and hoping that I can get some more work done, some more writing done. And then I may reappear again.
Yeah. Great. So thank you for taking out the time. It was a fantastic conversation. And I highly recommend people buying the book. It is available on all bookstores in New Zealand that you can buy from. I would also recommend, if you go to Bridget Williams' books, who are the publishers, their website, you can order it online. And also other places you can order it online as well. So get on it, buy the book. And Tekun, thank you very much. I hope you have a fantastic day, and I hope there is another book coming with your PhD thesis, and we'll talk again about that then.
Sounds good. Kia ora, thank you so much.
Thank you. Tēnā koe, everyone.